In winter on Oling Island, the music is frozen. People thaw it to drink and to boil their eggs in. The falls of the lower Olo are wondrous in December.
Welcome to another edition of Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host for today's show, Ken Jones. In this episode, we interview David Naiman, co-author of the new book, Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing from Portland's Tin House Books. David's book collects his KBOO Between the Covers interviews with Ursula K. Le Guin, the Portland-based master of science fiction, fantasy, poetry, essays, and pretty much any form she put her mind to. Ursula passed away in January of this year, and this volume, which originated in a remark she made to David during their third and final interview, "Maybe we should make this into a book," serves as a timely tribute to a great writer, a great thinker, and as you'll discover in this collection, a great conversationalist. In addition to hosting Between the Covers, David's a writer of fiction and essays. His work has appeared in several journals, including Tin House, Agni, Fiction International, Boulevard, and Ziziva. And his writing has been reprinted in the Best Small Fictions 2016 and cited in the Best American Essays 2015, the Best American Travel Writing 2015, and the Pushcart Prize Best of the Small Presses 2016 edition. David Naiman, thanks for being here on KBOO, and thanks for letting me ask the questions today.
No, it's great to be here, Ken.
You've been hosting Between the Covers, which is KBOO's weekly show about books and the people who write them, for several years now, I think going back to 2011. Do you remember your first interview?
Yeah, my first author was with Anthony Doerr.
Wow.
And you say wow, but what's really interesting is he was Anthony Doerr, but he wasn't Anthony Doerr.
Like All the Light We Cannot See had
right.
not come out yet.
And he was a writer's writer, and he had two really well-reviewed story collections. But he wasn't the international bestseller that he is now. So he didn't have that aura around him when I interviewed him. Though he was a very respected him, and then it was Nicole Krauss, another really well-regarded writer, were my two forays at the beginning.
And I'm not alone in saying this. I know that. You're now one of the best author interviewers, I think, in any medium. What was the learning process like from Anthony Doerr and Nicole Krauss to Ursula K. Le Guin?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that part of it's just being curious about what will make an author open up and be more generous with questions, which involves not just reading what you're going to talk to them about, but hopefully reading other things that they've written and then looking at other interviews that they've done and seeing where they seem to be more giving or where they might close up and not give as much of an answer.
And I think that's clear in this book, The Conversations with Ursula. You do quite a bit of preparation.
I do a lot of preparation, but I also think that we got to know each other better over time. And I think by the time we get to the third interview, which is at her house, I think we always had rapport, but I think there was more fellow feeling by the end where we were really in a groove.
Oh, yeah, it's truly conversation and not your typical Q&A interview. So let's get to that first interview. That took place in October 2015. It focused on Ursula's book, Steering the Craft, A 21st Century Guide to Sailing, The Sea of Story, which she had revised and published in a new edition. How did you arrange that interview, and were you already a big fan of her work?
I was already a fan of Ursula's work, for sure. And she had a long history of doing interviews here, which I think is really interesting. Like there are many, many hosts over the decades at KBOO that have interviewed with her. And I've thought a lot about that. I mean, I have my theories about why that's the case, because obviously she could have just done interviews with Bill Moyers or with Charlie Rose or Terry Gross. But I think that something about the KBOO mission statement, about its connectivity to the community and to the region. She was very devoted to small presses, to radical politics, to sort of a bioregional ethics, which I think all dovetails well with the radio station. But when Steering the Craft came out, the new edition of it, so the expanded edition of her craft book, it crossed my mind that she has books, as you mentioned in the introduction, in so many different genres. So not just science fiction and fantasy, but fiction that isn't either of those. Literary criticism, translations, essays, children's books.
Cat autobiographies.
Cat autobiography and poetry. And yet, I imagined that most of the interviews she was getting were probably about her science fiction and fantasy novels. And so I was thinking, this was an interesting opportunity. Let's talk about the craft of writing fiction and not focus specifically. We do talk about science fiction and fantasy, but we get there in an unusual way. We get there through looking at her opinions around sentences or around point of view or around pronouns. And by taking any one of those things that on the surface might seem boring, we end up in these interesting conversations about the environment or about class or about race and gender, and also about the difference between literary and genre fiction. So it felt like an opportunity to engage with somebody, but maybe in a way that was at a different angle than is the typical one.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing, got its start from something Ursula said in your third and last interview with her about a year ago. In your preface to that section of the book, you write, "At the end of the nonfiction conversation, I mentioned how rare it was to be able to talk with someone with such a deep history in all three genres, actually more, as you just kind of gave us, how unique this journey had been. In fact, I couldn't imagine who else I could have done this with. Maybe we should make this into a book," she answered. What was your first reaction to that? And how did you get from maybe we should make this into a book to this book that we have here right in front of us?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, the question that I, or the statement that I said to her, I know you and I, when we ran into each other the other day, were trying to come up with other names, and you'd mentioned maybe John Updike, but
that's the only name I could think of.
There's not a lot of people who have such a deep back catalog in all three genres, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. She has a long career in all three, and a very significant career in all three. And so when I said that to her, and then she said, "Why don't we make a book of it?" Of course, I was taken aback and delighted, and yet didn't know that that was going to be the magic wand, and here we would have a book eventually.
Did you think she was serious or off the cuff, just kind of a light remark?
No, she seemed serious about it, and she seemed serious about it. And originally, she was thinking, because all three of the books that we were engaging with recent books of hers as sort of jumping off points for those three genres. And all those books were at small presses, and some of them quite small. So one of them was engaging with a book that came out from an anarchist press in Seattle, or an anarchist press in San Francisco, and another one, a feminist science fiction press in Seattle. And she was suggesting, she made a joke that her agent was probably frustrated because she was always giving her books to these small presses that had didn't have huge distribution, but were both regional, and she liked that. They were outside of New York City. She liked that. And they also had a politics that she really admired. So she had a real ethics in these gestures. And I said to her, well, one thing we could consider that might both fulfill that and also make your agent a little happier, because it's a slightly bigger press, is Tin House Books. And I knew she had a history with Tin House. She'd published stories with them before. They're literally down the street from her house. So you have this sense of being in the family. I told her that they had just won. There's this organization called VITA, which is Voices of Women in the Literary Arts. And they do this thing every year called the VITA Count, where they look at Harper's and the London Review of Books and the New York Review of Books and look at how many women get published versus men, and also how many men and women get reviewed versus women get reviewed. And Tin House did really well, but they did even better once they saw their score. So like they were not only one that did well, but they were one that took it seriously and wanted to do better, not only with the amount of women in their magazine, but also who, whether it was a man or a woman reviewing in their magazine, that more people who were women were getting reviewed in the magazine. And then on top of that, they give fellowships to their workshop that are for undocumented writers.
And they have a very well-known summer workshop here every year in Portland.
And for the recently incarcerated. And so it seemed like a no-brainer to try Tin House. They also have a lot of craft books. So it's like, here we have all these things sort of coming together. Can keep it in the family. We can express Ursula's ethics, and we can make her agent a little happier. And so we presented them with the idea. We assembled the beginnings of the book, which the beginnings of the book were the three conversations that we had for KBOO. And Tin House was interested, and then we worked from there. So we both Ursula and I wrote original material for the book. And then one of the cool things about the reading experience versus the listening experience is you get excerpts. So, and entire poems and entire essays. So when she mentions a poem, we have the poem. If she mentions a translation, you see the original Spanish and then her translation. There are excerpts of some of her influences, Virginia Woolf and Tolkien, and excerpts of her own writing, and also some entire essays.
No, beautifully done too. That's actually white print on a black background.
Yeah, in the book. I like that.
Yeah, very well designed. So you talked about the sections there, and based on the three interviews, and so each one was a form. First one fiction, second poetry, and the third and final section nonfiction. And these are adapted from the interviews, which ran about an hour each, I think, initially. So there was a good deal of editing involved from the transcripts into book form. And you even mentioned that there was some original material written for the book.
Yeah, well, so...
Oh, the introductions, of course.
Yeah, so okay. I have an introduction to each section that is sort of orients the reader to the occasion of the conversation and also to the ways the questions that are being raised by Ursula in her art are different when she's engaging in this particular genre. So while there, of course, you see these repeating motifs from fiction to poetry to nonfiction, you see a different foregrounding of questions in each of the genres. So there's introductions around that. And then Ursula wrote this really wonderful, funny, and insightful and revealing introduction to the book as a whole.
A fear and loathing.
Fear and loathing in the interview.
In the interview.
And in a way, she walks us through all the ways in which she's been interviewed in terrible ways. And you learn, you really feel her personality in the introduction. And it's funny, but you also just get a sense of sort of this no-nonsense sense of Ursula and how much she's saw through a long life in the literary world. And that's one of the advantages, I think, of talking to her about craft, is she's seen things come and go, things that everyone is focused on now. She cautions people not to just jump on the bandwagon of, say, writing in present tense or writing really short sentences when it's really possibly a more of a fad. And it also has some limitations from a craft perspective. And then there's the fear that some of it's being influenced by corporate influence, by
what sells,
what people want to imagine they want to see published.
You're listening to Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking today with David Naiman, co-author of the new book, Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing, from Portland's Tin House Books. Now let's get to that introduction, Fear and Loathing in the Interview. As you mentioned, she describes at first the bad interviews.
Yeah.
And I guess there were quite a few. Her first really good one that she says in the book is Bill Moyers. And she describes it as the good interview is like a badminton rally. You know right away the two of you can keep that birdie in the air and all you have to do is watch it fly. And then she goes on, David, to describe your first meeting with her at KBOO in what she calls one of KBOO's lovable, terminally funky recording rooms, which probably is the very room we're sitting in now.
It is.
There's no funkier room in the city than the one we're in right now. So she writes there, David and I were a bit stiff and shy at first, of course, but we soon got going and I knew our bird was on the wing. And I wanted to ask you about your first impressions of Ursula, but it's already in the introduction. You wrote this beautiful passage there, and I wonder if you would read that for us.
Oh, sure. So this is an excerpt from the introduction to the fiction section. We met at the studios of KBOO, a largely volunteer-run community radio station in Portland's Inner East Side, to have this conversation. And my first impression of Ursula there was one of matter-of-fact groundedness, of someone who didn't suffer fools, someone whose wealth of experience had not merely accumulated over a long life well-lived, but had become something else altogether, had alchemized into a sort of lived-in wisdom. And with this wisdom, there seemed to be no patience for masks, for pretense. Confirmed again and again as we talked, my first impression of her became my lasting one. Was there a contradiction between this real, of this world Ursula and the imagined, otherworldly one? Strangely, there didn't seem to be. The real and the imagined were inseparable. A well-rooted writer whose imagination branched high into the sky. Yet the more I learned about Ursula's way in the world outside her books, the more it seemed like it was the unseen, the imaginary within them that was animating the real, not the other way around.
Now, can you explain that, how the the imaginary animating the real and not the other way around? Of course, that's in her fiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it goes to a deep philosophical position. So I would say that when she's talking about the difference between mimetic or realistic fiction, so what she would probably, what a lot of people call literary fiction, but she probably would have an issue with it being called literary fiction.
Exactly.
Compared to imaginative fiction, I think she would argue that if fiction doesn't include the imagination, if writing doesn't include the imagination, not just fiction, then it is less real, because the imaginative faculty is a very integral part of being a human being. So true realistic fiction includes and welcomes the imaginative faculty in it. And I think when you see the worlds that she has imagined, whether it's a gender fluid world on another planet, or a post-apocalyptic tribe in Northern California, you see a lot of the things that she's imagined in those worlds are the same things that are animating her choices to support regularly a radical community radio station in Portland, or a small press in Seattle and San Francisco. I think that it's that envisioning of the world that she wants to live in, that is the animating factor behind the choices she makes on the sentence level, and then also just moving around in the world.
And oddly enough, in the last section on nonfiction, she has this quote, which I think is very relevant to what you just said, David. I think the imagination is the single most useful tool mankind possesses. So she makes no bones about that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Of course, with the mimetic fiction and so-called literary fiction, she was very much against being typed as a genre writer, and well, also against writers who were writing literary fiction and were writing in a genre without really knowing the genre or studying it.
Yeah, I would say that she was very happy to be called a genre writer, but she wanted to be identified in that world. Unlike, for instance, Margaret Atwood.
I was just thinking of that, yes.
Yeah, but...
She admires Atwood quite a bit, it's obvious.
And they were good friends.
Uh-huh.
But so she's proudly in the world of science fiction and fantasy, though she doesn't like to have disregarded the things that she's written that are not that. So she doesn't want to just be called a science fiction and fantasy writer. But what she's really arguing is not, please don't call me a genre writer, but that genre writing is literature and is literary. The best of genre writing, just like the best of realistic writing, is literature. So that was a big battle that, in a lot of ways, I feel like she lived to see mostly won, as we've seen a lot of cross-pollination and a lot of those walls fall down.
And, of course, there's a lot of really great literary writers, so-called literary writers, who work in genres.
Right.
And across several genres, actually. Mm-hmm. I want to get to that final section again on nonfiction. The first two sections are based on interviews you actually did here in this funky little studio that we're in right now. But the third one, David, you actually went to Ursula's home along with Aaron Yankee, who's our program director here, to help you with the recording.
Yes.
What was that like? So there you were literally on her home turf.
That's right. So we found a quiet upstairs studio, a small room with a lot of book-lined room where there was less noise. So, and we still had to pause occasionally if like a truck was driving by or something was happening outside, but mostly it was a quiet room. We had tea. Her cat was sleeping on the bed in the bedroom next door, but
the famous pard.
The famous pard. and pard is famous because he was his autobiography was being posted on Ursula's blog and has since been made into a book.
So Pard was quite a writer himself.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Very literary household. Right.
Is that the room that Ursula writes in, where you conducted the interview?
I don't actually know. Oh. But it was interesting, of course, to peek at her bookshelf. She was deeply into the Elena Ferrante series at the time. And Of course, it's a very warm house.
And she's been there a long time, right? It's kind of an old style Portland house.
Yes, it's an old style house. It's lovely to be in.
David, in your preface to this section, the nonfiction section, you write, "You'll discover, as I did, that Ursula feels most at home in fiction and poetry, more uneasy in the world of declaration and assertion." This came as a surprise to me. In fact, in that section, Ursula herself says about writing nonfiction, "It's not my thing. It's not really my shtick." I wondered, why does she feel more uncomfortable writing nonfiction than her fiction works, of course, fantasy, sci-fi, and the poetry?
Well, it's interesting because not only has she written some really amazing essay collections, but she's also in the last decade of her life has given some truly remarkable speeches, which have been collected.
And you mentioned one in particular, the National Book Foundation
National
Award
Book Foundation Award, which went viral on YouTube. And
yeah, it was funny. She said, "My 15 minutes of fame."
Right, which is pretty funny from
I think she's had a whole lot more.
But that speech, which she was giving, she was receiving a lifetime award, and all the different publishers were at tables, and including Amazon. And the speech was largely directed at Amazon, who was in the room. And she had warned Neil Gaiman, who was presenting her, and then she was giving the speech, that this was going to happen. And it was a speech against the continued deepening commodification of books and of certain booksellers that were sort of undermining the health of sort of the book industry as a whole.
I.e. Amazon.
Amazon as the main culprit.
Right.
So she's clearly really good at giving speeches and writing essays, but I do think it is the assertion of, "This is what I believe, this is how it is," that she's uncomfortable with, because when you're in a fiction narrative, you're looking at multiple points of view and complexity. You're allowing the reader to enter into the world. It allows for more contradiction. And similarly, obviously, with poetry, when you're writing in lines, most often not narrative, it allows in sort of the negative capability that Keats talks about, and the consciousness of the other in a way that some essays and some speeches don't, but I would argue that Ursula's do. So even though it generated more anxiety for her, but I think the end result was equally as fascinating as her poetry and fiction. And in her best essays, you really feel her, you feel like you're along with her while she's thinking. And I think that's a real pleasure that you don't get in the same way in the fiction and the poetry.
I think that actually comes through in the conversations you have with her.
Mm-hmm.
It's you and her both conversing and her thinking out loud there.
Yeah, I hope so.
No, I think that's very clear. Now, David, you've interviewed many great writers, starting with Anthony Doerr. You've done George Saunders, Ursula, of course. I was wondering, are there any living writers still around that you admire and would love to talk with, like a bucket list here?
Well, there's a lot of them. I mean, like Toni Morrison?
Okay. Oh, wow, yes.
Right? I would think she would be near the top of the list. Though, because we're only interviewing people who are coming through Portland, that seems like an unlikely person that will happen.
Unless she reads at Powell's, and right. Where we get a lot of our interviews from.
I don't think she's traveling a lot now, but I'm sure if I had more time to think about it, I would have a really long list of people.
Toni Morrison, I think, is a pretty good name to mention there.
Yeah.
I hope you get a chance to talk with her.
Yeah, I would love that.
So I wanted to close, David, within the introduction to Conversation on Writing. Ursula writes about her interviews with you. I want to thank KBOO for letting us do it and for being, for 50 years, the strongest, consistent voice in Oregon of and for the arts and the freedom and generosity of thought. While America is busy tearing itself apart into factions with rant, lies, and mindless violence, it's in voices like this that you can hear, if you listen, what may yet hold us together. So, David, I want to thank you very much for talking with us at KBOO and for being one of those voices that Ursula mentions.
Oh, that's really nice. Thank you, Ken. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking with David Naiman, co-author of the new book, Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing, from Portland's Tin House Books. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to David for talking with us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.
Deep ocean, mother of music, in which all islands are silences, rest.